Hello and welcome again to Summer Talks on ABC Radio National. I'm Kate Evans, and at this time all this week, we're listening to the 2011 Reith Lectures, stories of freedom and fear, resistance and terrorism. Tomorrow, the international world of secrecy and surveillance. But tonight, we stick with the experience of being under surveillance and of necessity operating out of subterfuge. For the past 23 years, Aung San Suu Kyi has been fighting for freedom against the military dictatorship that rules Burma. Today, she is giving the second of her two BBC Reith Lectures entitled Securing Freedom, which were recorded in secret at her home in Burma. In her first lecture, Aung San Suu Kyi discussed what she called the unfreedom in which the people of Burma live and described the passion with which she and her supporters, like those who've recently taken to the streets in the Middle East, seek the right to liberty and democracy. In this second lecture, Aung San Suu Kyi describes how her party, the National League for Democracy, the NLD, has survived despite being officially ignored by the regime since it won a landslide election victory in 1990. She draws parallels with dissidents throughout the world for whom struggle has been their life's work. Let's turn then to the radio theatre in Broadcasting House London and the voice of Aung San Suu Kyi.
When I agreed, with great trepidation, to take on the Reith Lectures, it is based on the simple desire to discover what we are. By we, I mean the National League for Democracy, the NLD, as well as other groups and individuals who are engaged in the campaign for democracy in Burma. We have been engaged in the struggle for democracy for more than 20 years, so you might think we should know what we are. Well, yes, we do know what we are, but only up to a certain point. It is easy enough to say that we are members of a particular party, like the NLD or organization. But beyond that, things start to get a bit fuzzy. I was made acutely aware of this when I was released from my third stretch of house arrest last November. Perhaps I should explain. A lot happened while I was under house arrest, cut off from the world outside. Two of the most notable events, I was tempted to say mishaps, that happened in Burma were the referendum in 2008, followed by the general election last November. The referendum was supposed to show, or at least the Burmese military junta hoped it would show, that more than 90% of voters were in favor of a new constitution. A constitution which would give the military the right to take over all powers of government whenever it was thought necessary for the good of the nation. The first general elections in nearly 20 years were meant to follow according to what the generals, rather absurdly, called their roadmap to disciplined democracy. This is when it starts to get complicated. To take part in these elections, new political parties had to register with the Elections Commission along with all those parties which had previously registered back in 1988. They also had to undertake to protect and defend the Constitution drawn up 2 years earlier and to expel any of their members who were in prison, including those who were appealing against their sentences. This included me, as I would have to be expelled if the NLD wanted to register. Instead, it chose to carry on its right to remain as a political party in the law courts, although we were fully aware of the lack of an independent judiciary in Burma. So when I was released from house arrest last year, only days after the elections, I was faced with a barrage of questions. Two of the most frequent ones were, first, whether or not the National League for Democracy had become an unlawful organization. The second was how I saw the role of the party now that there was an official opposition which didn't include us. It was instead the handful of parties whose representatives now occupy less than 15% of the seats in the Burmese National Assembly. The first question was easy enough to answer. We were not an unlawful organization because we had not infringed any of the terms of the unlawful organization's law. The second, regarding the role of the party, was more difficult because the NLD's position has been ambiguous ever since the elections held in 1990, when we won more than four-fifths of the vote and shocked what was then known as the State Law and Order Restoration Council, the official name of the Burmese military regime. The years of military rule have produced a very rich collection of Orwellian terms. There are countries where elections have been rigged or hijacked, or where the results have been disputed or denied. But Burma is surely the only one where the results have been officially acknowledged in the State Gazette, followed by nothing. Nothing was done to provide a real role for the winning party or elected representatives, in spite of earlier promises by leaders of the junta that the responsibility of the government would be handed over to the winners once the elections were over and the army would go back quietly to their barracks. The most notable outcome of the elections in 1990 was the systematic repression of all parties and organizations, formal or informal, as well as individuals who persisted in demanding that the desire of the people of Burma for democratic governance be fulfilled. We may have won, but the election in 1990 heralded the beginning of lean years for the NLD. The party made determined efforts to keep itself alive, alive but certainly not kicking. To casual observers, it began to look moribund. Only the year before, the chairman of the party, Utenu, and other key members of the Movement for Democracy were imprisoned and had been placed under house arrest. When Utenu and I were released 6 years later, we found that many of our most effective activists were still in prison, had gone into exile or had died, some of them while they were in custody. Others were in poor health as a result of harsh years spent in jails that did not even provide the bare minimum of medical care. Most of our offices had been forced to shut down. Our activities were severely curtailed by a slew of rules and regulations, and our every move watched closely by the ubiquitous military intelligence. The MI, or MI, as some refer to it with lugubrious familiarity, could drag any of us away at any time. They preferred the dead of night, on any charge that took their fancy. Yet, in the midst of such unrelenting persecution, we had still remained an official political party, unlike today, and we began to be referred to as the opposition. So here we were, in opposition, but not the official opposition. Generally speaking, in countries that are democracies or that aspire to be or pretend to be democracies, the party that wins the largest number of seats in the elections forms the government either on its own or in coalition with other parties, while all other parties that are not included in the government would constitute the opposition. But when the party that won by a landslide majority is not allowed to perform the functions that the winning party would normally be expected to perform, but is steadily deprived of the most basic rights of a political party, what then is its role? Should we accept that we were the opposition after all, because we were in opposition to the government, whether or not that government is legitimate? In 1997, the State Law and Order Restoration Council was renamed the State Peace and Development Council. Was it because astrologers had advised that such a move was necessary to ward off the possibility of regime change, or because the junta was getting tired of jokes made at the expense of the acronym SLORC, which smacked uncomfortably of such artificial organizations as SMASH? We shall never know. The official explanation was that the new name indicated it was time for the junta to move on to bigger and better things, as they had succeeded in their declared intention of establishing law and order. Considering that the Burmese expression for law and order translates literally as quiescent, cowering, crushed, and flattened, perhaps we're not far from the truth. The regime's version of law and order was a state of affairs to which we were thoroughly opposed, A nation of quiescent, cowering, crushed and flattened citizens was the very antithesis of what we were trying to achieve. The shape of the NLD began to take on a sharper contour as we faced up to the challenges of the struggle to survive as a political entity under military dictatorship. We sought ideas and inspirations in our own culture and history, in the struggles for revolutionary change in other countries, in the thoughts of philosophers and the opinions of observers and academics, in the words of our critics, in the advice of our supporters and friends. We had to find ways and means of operating as effectively as possible within the perimeters imposed on us by the junta, while striving at the same time to extend the frontiers of possibility. Certainly, we could not carry out the functions that would normally be expected of an opposition party, but we didn't object to being referred to as the democratic opposition, although there were those who maintained that this description was inappropriate for a party that should rightfully be in office. I myself used the expression frequently because it is readily understood by most people, but I did not think that the lessons we might learn from opposition politics in established democracies could be applied practically to our situation. As repression intensified, those of us in the National League for Democracy felt our essential nature to be more and more distant from that of a conventional opposition. We were recognized as the political party with the strongest support both at home and abroad, and we carried the burden of responsibility that goes with such recognition. But we had none of the privileges that would have been accorded to such a party in a working democracy, and barely any of the basic rights of a legitimate political organization. We were at once much more and much less than an opposition. In one of the first public speeches I made in 1988, I suggested that we were launching out on our second struggle for independence. The first, in the middle of the last century, had brought us freedom from colonial rule. The second, we hope, would bring us freedom from military dictatorship. The prominent role students played when they rose up in the demonstrations of 1988 evoked images of the students who had swept the country along with them in the demonstrations for independence in the 1930s. Some of these students of a past era had become prominent national figures and served as members of the post-independence government or as party leaders until they were forcefully removed from the political arena after the military coup of 1962. Many of these veteran independence fighters were quick to join the movement for democracy and thus linked the new struggle to the old one. Yet there were many differences between the two, of which the most obvious was that while our parents had fought against a foreign power, we were engaged in combat with antagonists who were of the same nation, the same race, the same color, the same religion. Another difference, pivotal, though seldom recognized as such, was that while the colonial government was authoritarian, it was significantly less totalitarian than the junta that came into power in 1988. A well-known writer who had plunged into the independence movement as a young student and who had engaged in clandestine work for the resistance during the Japanese occupation told me in 1989 that she thought the challenges we had to face were far tougher than the ones with which she and her contemporaries had had to contend. Before and after the Second World War, rule of law protected the independence movement from extreme measures by the British administration. When war and the Japanese army came to the country, the presence of the newly created Burmese army, commanded by my father, acted as a buffer between the resistance and the worst elements of the occupation forces. We could draw inspiration from the triumph of our forebears, but we could not confine ourselves to our own history in the quest for ideas and tactics that could aid our own struggle. We had to go beyond our own colonial experience. The regime, meanwhile, preferred to remain shackled to the past, blaming colonialism for all the ills of the nation and branding the NLD and its supporters new colonialists. Scanning the world for ideas and inspiration, it was natural that we should have turned to our close neighbor, India. We sifted through the tactics and strategies of the Indian independence movement and the thoughts and philosophies of its leaders, looking for what might be relevant or useful. Gandhi's teachings on nonviolent civil resistance and the way in which he had put his theories into practice have become part of the working manual of those who would change authoritarian administrations through peaceful means. I was attracted to the way of nonviolence, but not on moral grounds, as some believe, only on practical political grounds. This is not quite the same as the ambiguous or pragmatic or mixed approaches to nonviolence that have been attributed to Gandhi's Satyagraha or Martin Luther King's civil rights. It is simply based on my conviction that we need to put an end to the tradition of regime change through violence, a tradition which has become the running sore of Burmese politics. When the military crushed the uprisings of 1988 by shooting down unarmed demonstrators with a brutal lack of discrimination or restraint, hundreds of students and other activists fled across the border to Thailand. Many of them were convinced that those who lived by the gun could only be defeated by the gun, and decided to form student armies for democracy. I have never condemned and shall never condemn the path they chose, because there had been ample cause for them to conclude the only way out of repressive rule was that of armed resistance. However, I myself rejected that path because I do not believe that it would lead to where I would wish my nation to go. Those who take up arms to free themselves from unjust domination are seen as freedom fighters. They may be fighting for a whole country or people in the name of patriotism or ideology, or for a particular racial or ethnic or religious group in the name of equality and human rights. They are all fighting for freedom. When arms are not involved, activists seem to have become the generic name for those who are fighting for a political cause. Civil rights activists, anti-apartheid activists, human rights activists, democracy activists. So, do we belong to the last two categories, since we are constantly speaking out for human rights and democracy? To say that those of us in Burma who are involved in the movement for democracy are democracy activists would be accurate, but it is too narrow a description to reflect fully the essential nature of our struggle. A scholar comparing Indonesia under President Suharto to Burma under army dictatorship wrote that in Burma's case, the military had held a coup against civilian politics in general. In light of this insightful observation, it can be deduced that the mission of the NLD was not merely to engage in political activities, but to restore the whole fabric of our society that civilians might be assured of their rightful space. We were not in the business of merely replacing one government with another, which could be considered the job of an opposition party, nor were we simply agitating for particular changes in the system, as activists might be expected to do. We were working and living for a cause that was the sum of our aspirations for our people, which were not, after all, so very different from the aspirations of peoples elsewhere. In spite of the stringent efforts of the military regime to isolate us from the rest of the world, we never felt alone in our struggle. We never felt alone because the struggle against authoritarianism and oppression spans the whole human world, crossing political and cultural frontiers. During the years I spent under house arrest, the radio, which was my link to the great outside, took me as easily to the far reaches of the globe as to the top of my own street. It was from the radio that I heard about NLD activities in the immediate vicinity of my house, just as it was from the radio that I learned of the breaching of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet bloc, the moves towards constitutional change in Chile, the progress of democratization in South Korea, the dismantling of apartheid in South Africa. The books I received intermittently from my family included the works of Václav Havel, the memoirs of Sakharov, biographies of Nelson and Winnie Mandela, the writings of Timothy Garton Ash. Europe, South Africa, South America, Asia. Wherever there were peoples calling for justice and freedom, there were our friends and allies. When I was released from house arrest, I took every opportunity to speak to our people about the courage and sufferings of black South Africans, about living in truth, about the power of the powerless, about the lessons we could learn from those for whom their struggle was their life, as our struggle is our life. Perhaps because I spoke so often of the East European movements for democracy, I began to be described as a dissident. Originally, Václav Havel did not seem to have been enthusiastic about the term dissident because it had been imposed by Western journalists on him and others in the human rights movement in Czechoslovakia. He then went on to explain in detail what meaning should be put on dissidents and the dissident movement in the context of what is happening in his country. He held that the basic job of a dissident movement was to serve the truth, that is, to serve the real aims of life, and that this endeavor should develop into a defense of the individual and his or her right to a free and truthful life, that is, a defense of human rights and a struggle to see the laws respected. This seemed to describe very satisfactorily what the NLD had been doing over the years, and I happily accepted that we were dissidents. The official status of our party, as seen by the authorities, matter little because our basic job as dissidents remains what it has been over the years, and the objectives of our dissent remains what it has been over the years.
On ABC Radio National, this is Summer Talks and the 2011 Reith Lectures. This is the second of two talks by Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. With her disembodied voice being heard in London, the audience is able nevertheless to respond with questions. Our apologies, the phone line she's on from Rangoon isn't great, which is of course part of the point of having your words constrained, having to speak in secret. But transcripts of this talk are available, and I'll give you details at the end of the lecture. Our moderator is the BBC's Sue Lawley. Over to her.
Well, now, Aung San Suu Kyi recorded that lecture recently at her home in Burma. We now hope to have her on a telephone line from that same room. Dorsu, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Just let me explain to you that with me here in Broadcasting House in London, I have Robert Gordon, whom I know you came to know very well when he was British ambassador to Burma in the late 90s, and who subsequently ran the Southeast Asia Department in the Foreign Office. I also have with me Xenia Dormandy, who was Director for South Asia for the White House and is now a senior fellow at Chatham House. And we have an audience of politicians and experts and dissidents from China and the Middle East, as well as Burma itself. I'm going to begin by asking Robert Gordon, who saw how your dissidence was treated by the regime when he was in Burma for 4 years. He's seen how the regime deals with the opposition. There was a moment, was there not, Robert, when the NLD's dissent began to bear fruit, when the regime actually engaged with Aung San Suu Kyi?
Yes, there was a little bit of a mini Burmese spring, just before Dorsu started her latest bout of house arrest in 2002-2003. when the NLD were allowed to reopen quite a number of their offices up and down the country. Dorsu was able to visit more and more outlying parts of Burma and address people in increasing crowds until the dreadful moment came in May 2003 when the shutters came down. There was this attack on her convoy, 70 of her colleagues were killed and she very nearly lost her life. But very recently, and this is perhaps something that Dorsu could shed light on, there has been a report that in fact behind the scenes there was some progress between the NLD and the military government in the shape of the then Prime Minister General Kin Yunt. And so the report says, but this is what it would be good to hear from Dorsu, an agreement of sorts was reached whereby the NLD would rejoin the National Convention. Perhaps, Dorsu, you could enlighten us to whether this report is true or not.
We may have lost...
I can't hear anything now.
What we'll do is we will just pause and we will carry on talking among ourselves and we will try to improve the line. I think that's the thing to do. But we do have Peter Popham, a journalist who's writing a biography of Aung San Suu Kyi. And I think you know about this moment when there might have been a breakthrough, there might have been engagement with the generals, don't you?
The true progress, such as it was, occurred after the attack on her in 2003. She was put back in detention. Sanctions were tightened because of the international outrage of that attack. Kin Yunt, the Prime Minister, had his status improved as a result of his colleague Than Shwet losing status within the triumvirate, as a result of which Kin Yunt sponsored negotiations via a brigadier underling of his called Than Tun. And according to Dorsu herself, after she was released last year, she said, in fact, we were almost there.
And what happened? What happened to that general?
At this point, Kin Yunt, the Prime Minister, went to Than Shwet with this agreement that had been hammered out with the NLD. Than Shwet, who was the senior general and the more powerful of the two, took fright, essentially, and within months, Kin Yunt had been sacked, sentenced to 40 years house arrest, and Than Tun, who had been in charge of the negotiations, was tortured and sent to jail for 130 years, where he still remains.
Let me bring in Mark Farmaner, who's director of the Burma campaign. Mark, do you see any possibility at all of progressing the cause of democracy, or do you think, you know, that was a kind of high point of the 23 years of struggle and it's never going to happen again?
Well, I think we need to be clear. Kin Yunt was no moderate. He was much better at playing a game with the international community and a better presenter. But he was still in charge of the torture chambers in Burma. And now you have a new dictator, Thein Sein, who is very much from the same stream as Than Shwe was. He's very hardline. He's got a hardline history. He, in Shan State in Burma, when he was commander there, he was named by the United Nations for ordering troops to commit human rights abuses. So it's very unlikely that we'll see any change come from him.
I think we've got Aung San Suu Kyi on the line again. We're discussing whether it was that in 2004 you engaged with a senior general and began to establish some dialogue with the regime. Can you confirm that that is the case?
Yes, I had some talks with three representatives of the regime, and I felt that those talks were genuine. I think we were trying to reach some kind of agreement. And as far as I can make out, those who were talking to me also thought that we had reached some kind of agreement. But at the last moment, just a few days before the National Convention, this all changed.
But you're pushing hard at the moment. You've given these lectures to the BBC. You addressed the US Congress last week. You're talking about intending to tour Burma, to tour the provinces. The generals have been patient so far. How much do you fear that their patience may run out?
I'm not sure that patience is a word that you should apply to them. After all, we've been patient for 23 years. And when you say that they have a patient, what do you mean? After all, it's my right as a citizen to travel around this country if I wish to. and it's my right as a citizen of this country to say whatever I believe to those who ask me what I think.
I'm going to bring in Zania Dormandy, who's a senior fellow at Chatham House and an expert in your region. Zania, what's your reaction to hearing the way Aung San Suu Kyi has described the narrative history of her struggle? Are there lessons there for us, actually, in how we should seek to influence what's going on in the Middle East, for example?
I think that's an excellent question. I think that there is a message that could be picked up. There has been some success in some areas of the Middle East. There has been less success in others. I think we can all guess which ones fit in which camps. And the question is, can we take some of the success? It was talked about a little bit in the first lecture of the use of technology, the difference between having an authoritarian regime that would shoot at their people versus those who don't. And I would ask Dorsu, are there lessons for the international community that you would like to see action from the international community that we saw perhaps in the Middle East, particularly in Egypt perhaps, and in Libya, that we haven't seen in Burma?
I don't think the world was as interested in what is going on in Burma as it is now in what is going on in the Middle East. It may be because they're much more aware of what is happening there. It may be because there are differences between the strategic position of Egypt and the strategic position of Burma. But I think that I would like the world to care for each and every bit of the world in the same way when it comes to basic human needs.
I'm going to bring in Malik al-Abda, because I want to talk about, you talked in that lecture about the methods of dissent employed, and you talked about violence versus non-violence. Malik al-Abda is a Syrian dissident and a television journalist who's now in exile in London. Malik, your question, please, to Dorsu.
In your first lecture, you talked about the possibility of a change in tactic given the brutal nature of the junta in Burma. How seriously would you consider supporting violence to achieve goals?
I wouldn't support armed action just because somebody else is calling for it. Well, I place all my hopes in the young people of our country, but I wouldn't support armed action simply because they call for it. I think if I were to support violence, it would only be because I believe that a short burst of violence, if you like, will prevent worse things happening in the long run. Only for that reason would I ever support violence if I were to support it.
I'm going to bring in Sue Lloyd-Roberts, who's a foreign correspondent who's worked for many of the major UK TV news channels, Dorsu, and she's most recently been undercover in Syria, so she's no stranger to the activities of a repressive regime. Sue, your question.
Yes, I've just come back from Damascus, Dorsu, and you may or may not know that you are an icon on the streets of Damascus. I met a Syrian woman protester, a very brave woman, who led the women of her district out onto the streets despite the fact that army snipers were shooting from the rooftops, and she said you were her inspiration. I have one question for you. You were quoted recently as saying that a charade of democracy can be much more dangerous than outright dictatorship. I assume by that you meant the junta's recent elections. Do you think the international community and some people in Burma have been fooled by them?
I think rather than fooled, I think people want change so much that they are deceiving themselves. They want to see change, so they want to see change so much that they start saying that there has been change. So far, as I can see, there has been no real change as yet. There have been lots of very beautiful words, but those are not enough.
Is it your view that the recent elections, albeit they were rigged, but then the release of Aung San Suu Kyi has damaged the cause of democracy in Burma? Is that what you're suggesting?
The release, no, because she has proved to be a huge inspiration and has done a huge work of advocacy since she has been released. But there's no doubt that I think the elections let a lot of people off the hook. You heard a lot of international politicians say, well, you know, these generals are trying, and surely that can be a very dangerous thing to think, which is why Aung San Suu Kyi so rightly said that a charade of democracy can be so dangerous.
How far, Robert Gordon, are the people of Burma themselves fooled by it? After all, they're surrounded by a lot of other autocratic nations, aren't they? Might the Burmese people actually think across the land that they're not doing too badly?
No, it's true that there are members of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which embraces many different forms of rule and sorts of democracy, some of which are highly qualified. So by the ASEAN yardstick, it's possible that even this highly suspect election may not be so totally out of character. But I think that the Burmese people are very careful to listen, not least to the BBC and other radio stations that broadcast into Burma, about themselves, and they will have certainly heard the many irregularities that have marked these elections, and they will have seen for themselves how very different they were to the last real elections that happened in 1990.
Is that why you want to get out into the provinces, Dorsu? You actually want to talk to people beyond Rangoon to find out what they're thinking?
Yes, and I think it's very important to be in touch with the people. After all, if you're in politics, it means you have to work with people. It's not just to go out and campaign. People use the word campaign. They say that I'm going out on a campaign trip. It's not so much that. Let's say that I want to go on a contact trip.
But your problem is it not, is that your party's been splintered by these elections because you boycotted the elections for reasons you've explained to us. But other parties stood, other members of your party wanted to stand, and other ethnic minorities stood in Burma. So, in a way, the opposition has got fragmented, which is exactly what the regime wanted, isn't it?
I wouldn't say that the opposition has got fragmented, because I think I can say truthfully that the NLD has the greatest support in Burma still. And it's with the support of the people that we are remaining as a political force.
I'm going to bring in Min Hine here because he's a member of the youth wing of the NLD. And again, talking about these ethnic minorities, as I understand it, there are 35% of the Burmese population belong to an ethnic group, of which there are many. There are about 135 or more in all, aren't there? So, you know, it's a difficult issue. Your question.
This is Min Hine. Could you please briefly explain how a democratic Burma will promote peace and respect among many different ethnic people of Burma and many different cultures?
The question really is, how would you promote peace and respect among all those different cultures and ethnic minorities, because they are so diffuse and so different, and they are 35% of the Burmese population?
I think we all have to promote it by respecting one another, mutual respect and mutual understanding. This has to be built up over the years, and it cannot happen overnight. But I believe this can happen because we have very good ethnic nationality allies. When I went around Burma before I was put away in 2003, the greatest support I found was in the ethnic nationality areas. They were so warm and so very genuine in the way in which they demonstrated their support for us.
Xenia Normandy, let's talk about sanctions and trade. I mean, China spends $4 billion. Well, what is it? What does it spend? What does China spend in Burma?
A significant amount of money.
A huge amount.
I think the issue with China, with India, with the United States, with Europe, the question is interests versus maybe moral obligation. And it's an issue that was addressed in the first lecture, I think, as well, which is how there is perhaps a moral obligation to act. We heard President Obama talk about a moral obligation when he chose to put the U.S. to be involved in Libya. But how do you measure that against a national interest, whether it's trade, whether it's energy, whether it's protecting one's borders? And I think if you look at the international community activities in Burma, or lack of activity, and you compare that to what's gone on in the Middle East, North Africa, a lot of it comes down to this question of where does the moral obligation, balanced with the national interest, demand that our actions take place?
But if self-interest is the only thing on which you base your actions, I mean, China sees Burma as a ripe fruit to be plucked, doesn't
Absolutely. It? Absolutely, and China needs an awful lot of energy, and India doesn't want to see China take over Burma. So
well,
you have a.
It's frightened because it would get naval bases and.
Absolutely.
Which would be very threatening. I'm going to bring in Lee Jones, who lectures in international relations at London University. Lee, your question, please, to Aung San Suu Kyi.
What do you think the concrete impact of Western sanctions has been on Burma?
I don't think the impact economically is that great, but I believe there has been an impact for the very simple reason that this present regime is still very eager for the sanctions to be removed. And the economic effect of sanctions, as has been clearly explained by organizations like the IMF, is really quite small. So it's a political impact on the government that is important.
Let me call in Simon Tisdall, a foreign affairs columnist and leader writer for The Guardian, of which he's also assistant editor. Simon Tisdall, your point, please.
Well, Dorso, you set your Burmese struggle in an international context, indeed a context of universal rights and obligations. I'm wondering, are you dismayed, disappointed even, that countries coming out of post-colonial situations like South Africa, which you praised the struggle there, India, Brazil, as well as China, these leading developing powers around the world, have not taken a stronger line on Burma and have not shown the support and solidarity that if we really are to have change there, the international community needs to exert?
I am disappointed, of course. But at the same time, I'm afraid that we have got rather used to it. That's when democracy movements and human rights movements are in opposition, then they take a different line. But once they get into government, some of them are not as supportive of struggles in other places as we might have expected them to be. There are exceptions, of course, and such as Czech Republic now. President Václav Havel was very, very supportive of our movements for democracy, and there are individuals like Desmond Tutu who are exactly the same. But I would wish more countries and more leaders to be like them, to remain true to the values for which they fought once they have succeeded in their struggle, not to forget those who are still struggling.
But Robert Gordon, looking at it from the Western perspective and the sanctions that we impose from the West on Burma, and they are pretty thorough and they're renewed by the EU every year, I mean, it doesn't matter, does it, to Burma? Burma is invulnerable, is it not, to any sanctions from the West?
In the sense that sanctions can really bite economically, you're right, until such time as the neighbours, that's Thailand, India and China, were to really come on board a proper hard sanctions policy, then it won't have the economic impact. But as Dorsu has said, that's not the point. They still do exert a political impact, and because they are seen to be inconvenient, the government want them removed.
But on the other hand, the Burmese regime is isolationist by its very nature, isn't it? Its default position is to cut itself off from the rest of the world.
It is, but if I could just widen the discussion a bit towards the ASEAN neighbours, I think it might be worth looking a little bit at the role of Indonesia. Indonesia has had a negative impact on the Burmese situation in one respect, in the sense that the former Indonesian role model, where the army had a dual function, politico-military function, has now very much been taken up as the role model in the new constitution of Burma. So that's perhaps not very helpful, but the new Indonesia is slowly sorting itself out, and it, I would thought, is now in a better position to start exerting its traditional leadership role within ASEAN. And there one would hope that the Indonesian president and his colleagues could perhaps play a more influential role behind the scenes in mobilizing ASEAN persuasion, they don't like the word pressure, on their fellow member of ASEAN, namely Burma.
But Dorsu, Burma is in line to take the chair of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, in 2014. Its turn. Would you like to see that go ahead, or would you call for it not to be allowed?
As I understand it, it's in 2016 that Burma should become the chairman of ASEAN. but for some reason this government seems to be very keen to take on the chairmanship earlier in 2014. I think it would help a great deal if the ASEAN nations were to make it very clear that if they wish to take the chair of ASEAN at an earlier date, they've got to prove that they have done something to make them worthy of taking the chair of ASEAN earlier than the date on which they should take it.
I'm going to call in David Steele, because I think this line is fading on us slightly, and I do want to get your question in before the end. Lord Steele.
I want to ask a more personal question. I knew your husband, Michael, during his terminal illness, and I know how distressed you both were when he was refused a visa to come and pay a last goodbye. And I've also been in Cairo recently talking to members of the Youth Coalition who saw some of their colleagues killed. And my question is there too high a price to pay for dissent?
I don't think so, because if you think of what many of my colleagues have had to give up, what they have had to go through, then I don't think you would even ask me the question, have I paid too high a price? There are many others who have paid much more, a much higher price for their beliefs.
Did you expect her to say anything else, David Steele? A question for you now, while we've still got you, from Con Coughlin, the foreign editor of the Daily Telegraph.
Dorsu, you spoke in your first lecture of your excitement at recent events and developments in the Middle East. There's a lot of excitement here in the West, but there's also a lot of confusion in the West about how to support the aspirations of the pro-democracy campaigners in the Middle East. Do you think that the West's support for these movements is a help or a hindrance?
It's a hindrance. I think it is a help, but I think perhaps you need to change some of your tactics if you have to win over those who consider it wrong. Now, then I'm thinking you're going to go on to ask me how you should change your tactics. That I cannot really say, because obviously there are some who believe that there are things that you're not doing right. But I do not see why these cannot be changed if necessary.
I've got one more point for you. Say who you are.
Hi, I'm Brad Adams. I'm the Asia Director at Human Rights Watch. One of the things you said at the last lecture that was most impressive was that you felt mentally free throughout all of your ordeal. And what we've seen from change in other countries is that change happens when something happens within a regime. Their mental state changes. And I'm wondering what you think could change the leadership of the regime, the rank and file in the army. What would make them change their worldview so that they would accept the principles and the values that you espouse?
I think it would help a great deal if they could be exposed to other people's thoughts much more. I think we do not get through enough to the regime, partly because they've cut themselves off deliberately from the people, and partly because there is not enough effort from all directions to make them see that things are not necessarily the way they think they are.
What more could the West do to help your campaign within Burma?
As much as you can. The first important thing is the first thing is to keep up an awareness of what is happening in Burma and then work on that. A lot of people don't really know what is going on in Burma. We talked earlier about whether there has been real change or not. And I think you need to look into this matter more closely to find out whether there has been real change or whether it is just that you want to see real change.
Xenia Dormandy, do you feel that there may well be a moment when, you know, the generals make another big mistake, which of course they did when the monks rose up in 2007, suddenly they were putting up the price of food or reducing the value of savings. Do you feel that that is in the end how it will happen, the big it, that the generals will make a big mistake and there's going to be much more communication as there is in the Middle East and the whole thing could take off?
I think that maybe I will revert to two things that President Obama has said in the last 2 months or so. One of them is that these drives have to be internally led, not externally led. And the second is, notwithstanding President Obama's insistence that U.S. actions in Libya followed a moral obligation as much as anything else, I don't think that one should expect the United States the European community, other Western powers, to choose the moral right over the national interest. And so I think that there has to be a question for those within Burma is there a way, given the changes taking place both within and without, is there a way to change the calculation so that national interests become more powerful, become more relevant? Is there a narrative that can be explained as to why democracy in Burma is so important that the international community should be taking actions that are otherwise not directly perceived to be in the national interest? And I think that's the narrative that we have to come up with.
Dorsu, music to your ears, hmm?
Yes, but I think I would like to say that we would like more done on the basis not just of democracy in Burma, but fairness and justice throughout the world. And we are part of the world. And it is not just that you're doing something for Burma when you help us in our democracy movement. I think you are helping the whole world to have greater access to fairness, to justice, to security, to freedom. I would like people to think of it like that. Not just that we're helping this particular country or that particular country, but as promoting more security, more freedom, and more justice in this world.
A last thought from you, Robert Gordon, before we say goodbye. It would be very easy to say that very little had been achieved by the National League for Democracy over the past 23 years because there hasn't really been any continued engagement or any beginning, only one small beginning, as we heard, of engagement with the regime. No freedom has been won. There's no dialogue. Has anything been achieved that you felt when you were there, and you can put your finger on now, by the heroic efforts of Aung San Suu Kyi?
Well, I think internally she has kept the flame of hope alive in a long and very dark period of Burmese politics, and that's an enormous achievement in itself. And we heard from Sue Lord Roberts and others that in today's Syria and other countries, there are many, many people who look from outside at what Dorsu is trying to do in her country and are drawing inspiration for their own countries.
Dorsu, are you happy with that as a summary of your achievements, that you've kept the flame alive?
I would not like to think of it as my achievement, but talking about what the NLD has done or not done. But to put it all in a nutshell, we have done as much as I think any party could do under the circumstances.
And here's an easy question for you to end on. How much have you enjoyed being our REIT lecturer 2011?
Oh, I've enjoyed it tremendously. I was very nervous about it, but I've enjoyed it very much because it gave me a chance to do what I enjoy doing, reading and writing, and communicating with people who are interested in the kind of things that I'm interested in.
Well, I think the world is interested in the kinds of things that you're interested in, Aung San Suu Kyi. Thank you very much indeed. There we must end it. In September, 10 years on from 9/11, the former Director General of Britain's Security Service, MI5, Eliza Manningham Buller, will be delivering 3 REIT lectures, also under the title of Securing Freedom. She will talk about securing the freedom of those of us who already enjoy it against those who would take it away. But for now, our thanks to our audience here in London and a very special thank you to our first REIT lecturer of 2011, Aung San Suu Kyi.
If you found it difficult at times to hear Aung San Suu Kyi clearly due to the poor quality phone lines from Rangoon, then you'll be glad to hear that transcripts are available from the BBC. We'll post a direct link on the Summer Talks website. abc.net.au/rn/summertalks. I'm Kate Evans, and please join me tomorrow night for another woman who engages with politics and the idea of freedom from a different perspective. Dame Eliza Manningham Buller is the former Director General of MI5, and she's talking terrorism and power. So join me again tomorrow night after the news at 6. Bye for now.
On On the health report, gold plating your coronary arteries to see whether there's trouble brewing, what hip and knee replacements do for your weight, and what to do when a knee replacement goes wrong.
What happens with these patients is they leave the hospital with a very satisfactory range of motion. Then rather than increasing their range of motion starts to diminish despite doing all the things that they're supposed to do.
That's with me, Norman Swan. And if you want to hear it, why not download a health report podcast from Radio National's website?